Okay, I'm recording. All right, so the students asked a lot of really good questions, and I think, you know, one of the first ones sort of gets at almost pretty much what I'd consider a core theme that runs through the book. And he says, given Google's mentality to approach ideas from a quantitative aspect and not one which uses experience or judgment, what problems do you foresee when issues such as privacy or piracy are brought up? Wouldn't using experience or judgment seem a wiser approach to take compared to their current focus on efficiency and quantitative metrics?
I think one of the real challenges for Larry Page as the new CEO and for Google in general is that they've moved from a business that was anchored in engineering algorithms, and where the logic of an algorithm was sufficient to make Google a success, and to a world where relationships matter more. That is to say, your relationships with government, your relationships with Hollywood for content, your relationships with book publishers and content providers in terms of copyright questions, and your relationships with the public and therefore governments in regard to privacy questions, not to mention governments in regard to should all information be freely available. Think, does China, does Iran want all information to be freely available? So suddenly there's a limitation to the engineer's algorithmic approach to the world, and Google has to adjust to that reality, and it is not a particular strength of theirs.
In talking about relationships, sorry, I got distracted for a second. In talking about relationships, do you think that's something that a company like Google can learn, or you know, can hire, or are they just sort of, you know, is their fate already written, do you think?
I don't think anyone's fate is written, but I think that it's very hard for them to adjust to this new world. This is not just a question of hiring lobbyists, which they've begun to do, of being more aggressive in dealing with governments, not just in the U.S., but the European Union and China and elsewhere. So ultimately, the buck is going to stop at Larry Page and the engineering culture's desk. And that engineering culture is very impatient with what they see as the inefficiencies of governments, for instance, or the inefficiencies of legacy media like Hollywood studios or television networks or newspapers and magazines and book publishers. And that's the clash where they, you know, from their vantage point, these are inefficiency questions. Wouldn't it be more efficient, they say, to have all the world's information available? Wouldn't it be more efficient to be able to freely copy everything in libraries and on books and make it part of search? It would be more efficient. On the other hand, it then bumps into questions like copyright and who owns the content, are you compensating for the content, and questions like privacy. One of the issues here is the different value system that suddenly is playing out. In the world of the engineer, data is virtuous because data tells you how people are behaving, what they like, what they don't like. It could tell you what viruses are suddenly taking hold around the world. There's a virtue to that, and it allows you to know more. And that's something that the engineer extols. On the other hand, if you're a citizen, do you want people to know more about you? Do you want advertisers to know what you like and don't like, and what you read and don't read, or watch and don't watch, what ads you like? Do you want to share that information? That's a basic question, and just one of many. That's a privacy question. Then you got the copyright question. Then you got the question of size. One of the things that engineers are not good at, because they're very high IQ but lower EQ, is they don't know how to measure things like fear. People fear size in America. They fear the dominance of a company like Google, which has, you know, 2/3 market share in search. And might, in fact, and this is one of the suits that the FTC is considering bringing against Google, are they favoring their search results? Are they favoring content that they own? A basic question.
Well, you know, I grant you that there's a certain strain of fear of size. I also think there's a love of choice. And I believe when, I think it was me who asked Eric Schmidt this question. I was certainly there when he was asked it. You know, what about the privacy issue? And his answer was, well, we'll let you opt out if you don't want advertisers to track track you. You have the choice to opt out. Now, if you opt in, you're going to get all these great other features that we give you. But if you'd rather not have those features, you don't have to, and so you can opt out. So, wouldn't that be sort of a logical and engineering-driven answer that can address the issues you're bringing up?
It does, but then you look at how complicated it is to opt out. And it may not be something that is consumer friendly, and it's not, and to most citizens. So what the privacy advocate comes back and says, why not have something where you only can do this, share the information of a consumer's behavior with an advertiser, let's say, if the consumer decides to opt in, why don't you just start out that everyone has opted out, and if they want to participate, they have to opt in. And that's something that no digital company favors.
No, and
Facebook.
And I've actually, my company has participated in some videos with the Interactive Advertising Bureau, which is the major trade organization
of the
digital advertising industry. And you know, they say that if you flipped it like that, that you would destroy $3 billion or more dollars worth of revenue in an instant, because people would not, you know, would not automatically opt in if they were given the choice.
There's no question there would be economic consequences to that, and that's one of the reasons why it's so complicated. By the way, I mean, I love the fact, take one example, when I go on Amazon and I purchase a book, I love the next time I go on Amazon, they say, we know you purchased these books on American history, let's say, these new titles are also now available, would you be interested? I like that it allows me the experience I get in a bookstore of browsing. And it's geared to my taste. I don't want to lose that option. So there are values, valuable things I get from Amazon or Google having my cookies. When I do a search on jobs and it instantly knows I'm talking about Steve Jobs, not jobs in the economy, that saves me a couple seconds. I like that. Okay?
Right. Well, getting to the, you know, to boil down what you said about Google and Larry Page and the engineering mindset, it's almost like you're saying basically they have a tin ear when it comes to these sort of emotional issues. How do you get around that? I mean, you know, if you have a tin ear, can you, you know, if you're a little tone deaf, can you become more sensitive to tone?
You can, and there are examples of that happening at Google. For instance, Google decided, without asking for permission, which is basically a basic way they operate, they don't ask permission, they just do it. And it's one of the reasons they're bold, successful companies.
Well, the old saying is better to beg forgiveness than ask permission, right?
And that's what they did say in deciding to digitize all the books. They just went ahead and started digitizing books. They didn't ask the permission of the copyright owners, the book publishers, or the authors. And what happened? The book publishers and the authors sued them and ultimately compelled Google to back down and say, well, we better negotiate because otherwise we're going to be tied up in lawsuits. And that has happened in a number of areas. It happened with the AP, Associated Press. They did the same thing with their wire service, and the AP threatened to sue them, and Google backed down there too. So there are examples. Look at what happened with China. Google basically tried to work out something with China, and ultimately and compromised with the Chinese government in terms of allowing them to sanitize certain search results, like Tiananmen Square, the Dalai Lama, for instance. Mm-hmm. And then Google found it was too onerous and quit and stopped. But essentially, there are examples of Google backing down. They've done it with YouTube, where suddenly they're beginning to pay for content because they realize they need professional content. The engineer thought, God, wouldn't you, all this user-generated content, all the advertisers would love to reach a large audience of user-generated. Well, advertisers didn't love reaching it because they want their friendly ads in a predictable, friendly environment. And the only way they get that is if you have professional content. So Google, there are lots of examples of Google backing down and changing. The problem problem is that once, you know, the problem is the same problem Microsoft had a decade ago. If the government decides to bring a monopoly lawsuit, will that tenure that Google has be the same tenure that Microsoft had and wind up in a federal court and it's too late to settle?
So you... Well, too late to settle. So you're saying you see that danger, that train wreck, whatever analogy you want to bring. You see that possibility as a real danger for Google.
I do.
Do you think? There's a fascinating, thesis that runs through your book I'd like to ask. Is Google? You are, as I've said in writing, perhaps the preeminent media writer in America ever. There's almost an assumption in the fact that you did this book that Google is a media company. Do you think Google's a media company?
Of course, and so do they.
They denied it publicly.
No. There's a quote in the book. I asked Eric Schmidt. This is on the record. It was taped. I mean, it's there. It's near the beginning of the book somewhere, where I ask Eric Schmidt, "What's your aspiration?" And he said, "I hope we will become the first $100 billion media company." He didn't say digital company. He didn't say search company. He said media company. And that's who they are. Now, they may deny it because they think it looks bad, and creates some political havoc for them. But they are competing with Hollywood studios and book publishers and newspapers and Hollywood studios, television, movies, with phone companies. I mean, that's the nature of who Google is. They are not just a search company anymore. And they know it. And by the way, more important, so does every media company know it. They know that they are in many ways in competition with Google. In some ways, they cooperate with Google. Look at the phone companies. They get Android from Google, a free operating system. But they have to worry when they take Android. Will Google at some point say, "Well, it's free now, but we're going to start charging you," or "We're not going to charge you, but we insist on a large slice of whatever revenues you get," or "We insist on what apps can be put on the Android operating system." So the phone companies have this love-hate relationship with the Google. By the way, so do the Hollywood studios. With worrying about YouTube. And so do advertisers who worry that Google is really in the advertising business, which they are.
Okay, so if I'm a a YouTube person, I say to the Hollywood studio, "Why do you hate us? We're giving you this opportunity to display your content, show essentially what are promotional videos. Not only do these promotional videos give you the opportunity to sell more DVDs, drive more people into the movie theaters, but your promotional videos can make money because we'll share the revenue of the ads that show on the promotional videos. So what's the problem, Hollywood?"
The problem is severalfold. One is that there is no question it's a double-edged sword. There are many ways that Google becomes a platform for not just Hollywood studios, but for all media companies. I mean, if in fact it helps me sell ads for the New York Times online or through Google News, I love that. That's another revenue stream for me, right? That's good. And if in fact you allow me to put my TV shows on YouTube as well as sell them to Hulu or display them on Hulu or sell them to Netflix, or maybe some other platforms, that's great. We're in a multi-platform world, and Google is a very dominant platform. So great. So let's figure out a way we can work together, and you get some benefit, and I get some benefit. That's Google's sales pitch to them. But the worry you have, anytime you're dealing with someone who has a powerful platform, what is the point at which they're going to start making demands that you find onerous?
What kind of demands?
Yes, we want CBS shows, but you're gonna have to pay us, one third, which is exactly what, by the way, what Apple does. Apple says, yeah, we'll give you access to our iPhone or iPad platform, but we take, we only give you a third of the revenue, and we keep two thirds. A and B, we keep all the data and the information.
Wait, isn't Apple the opposite? Apple is, we keep a third, you get two thirds. But your point is well taken.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm sorry. It's a third is the other way, right? right.
Yeah, Apple gets 30%.
But the
data is really even more important.
Which is one of the reasons why Apple has had a very hard time getting the support magazine apps. And now they've relented.
A little bit, yes.
But that's the pressure. And what has happened, one of the reasons that Apple has relented, just as Amazon was forced to relent, when you have multiple platforms competing, when in fact Kindle was the 80% market leader for e-books, they didn't have real competitive platforms. Now suddenly they have the iPad comes along as a platform to compete for e-books, and the Nook comes along to compete, and now Google comes along to compete, and suddenly Amazon is compelled to allow publishers to set prices on e-books, which they didn't want to do. And the same thing happens if you have multiple platforms to compete against YouTube or against the iPad.
Well, in this context, Google is looking like the good guys because Apple says, we're going to take 30%, we're going to keep your data, and Google says, well, we'll only take 10%, and you can have your data.
And we'll share the data.
Yeah, we'll share the data. Right. We keep it all, but we'll share it with you.
This is not a simple thing. The good guys and bad guys switch hats all the time in this world.
Huh.
And that's one of the things that makes it so interesting. That Google, which was perceived as a bully and a thief when it said we're gonna digitize all the books in the world and was sued by the publisher and the Authors League, suddenly the Authors League and the publishers come in and say, after negotiating, and say, hey, wait a second. Google has agreed to pay $125 million for copyright. It's the first time a major digital company has acknowledged such a thing as a copyright. That's fabulous. So we'll be their partners now. This is changing all the time. Look at how publishers felt when the iPad was. I was at that press conference when Steve Jobs announced the launch of the iPad a year and a half ago, and publishers attended in California, in Silicon Valley, and they were just thrilled. They said, "Oh my God, this is the Jesus tablet. You know, it's going to save us. Why? Because it's going to save us from Amazon, which has too much market dominance." So yet you look at the music business, which hated Steve Jobs, and now they say, "Well, wait a second, maybe he can help us." Isn't this great? So the sides are changing all the time in this world.
So Google has this really strong engineering approach. Media companies have a lot of relationships. Do the media companies have anything to learn from Google?
Oh, much more than Google has to learn from them, yes. I think one of the things among the many things that media companies have to learn, media companies are very slow to understand how the digital world was changing their world. And they basically sat and protected their legacy business and didn't think enough about how do I get into the digital business? How do I migrate my newspaper so it's an online newspaper? Not just a newspaper that, like we did 15 years ago, where we said, well, we'll set up a NewYorkTimes.com or whatever the newspaper was, .com. But it's going to be report to the newspaper editor, and B, they won't be allowed to publish a story until it appears in the newspaper the next morning, right?
Yeah,
which
sure.
Which defeats the purpose of the 24/7 notion of the internet.
Right.
So they have to realize that, and one of the things they have to do is they have to bring engineers into more prominence at these media companies and listen to those engineers, because in the new world, the engineer is really a content creator. If that engineer who created Facebook gives you an option to spend 2 hours a day on Facebook, which many people do, that engineer is a content creator. If I'm spending 2 hours a day on Facebook, that's 2 hours a day I'm not spending reading a book or watching television or going to a movie. So you have to think of the engineer as a content creator, and you better have them at your side. And trying to figure out how do we take our existing business and migrate it to the digital world, A. B, how do we market, be it through social networks or whatever, or Google search, how do we market our business, our new website, so that it attracts people? Because the traditional ways of attracting people, 30-second ads on television, full-page newspaper ads, are not as effective in terms of getting people to go through maze of all these choices you have on the web and find your choice.
What is it, what is the content that a Facebook engineer creates?
He creates the platform that you want to spend time on.
Okay, so the media he's creating is the platform.
Yeah, it is not a narrative. It is not a narrative media he's creating, but he's creating media that captures your attention. And if it captures your attention, why isn't it content?
Okay.
And that's my argument.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, because it's easy to see why somebody creating video or even games, but you're taking it even further and saying somebody actually writing code.
I'm saying the platform becomes media.
And this is an argument, you know, that I've confronted very personally, professionally, and also I see in discussions. You know, I go to a lot of conferences, and more newspaper and other executives are saying, you know, we need to treat the hiring of our engineers and coders as highly as we treat the hiring of a reporter or a scriptwriter. And I personally have, you know, found that to hire a really good coder can cost me 3-4 times as much as to hire a reporter or an editor. So there's a lot of competition for those people right now.
Yeah, and one of the worries a company like Google, all these companies in the Valley have, is that you don't have enough engineers in our engineering school. And the immigration laws are not relaxed, are restrictive, so you can't. You're limited to how many you can hire from overseas.
You talk about people being able to attract people online. Of course, the other side of that double-edged sword is that the revenue from online just does not match the revenue from traditional.
It's a huge problem. I mean, the average reader of the New York Times spends 35 minutes a day reading the New York Times. The average reader of the New York Times online spends 34 minutes a month reading the Times. So what that means is that the advertiser, looking at will not spend the same amount of money for an ad online as he or she spends for an ad in the newspaper. In fact, they'll spend about a tenth. That's the average ratio. So the problem is that if your newspaper went online totally and you got rid of the print paper, you would save roughly 60% of your cost. You save the cost of paper, printing, and distribution. And that's a huge saving. The problem is that the gains you get in advertising may not compensate for the gains, the cost-saving gains. And that's the economic problem that newspapers and magazines face.
Well, isn't one of the... Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No. And so the question is, how do you... If you migrate, which is happening, to an online, say, newspaper or magazine, how do you deal with the economics of it? And one of the things that, for instance, came out of that Columbia Journalism School paper that we read is that they made the argument that you have to do something that the New York Times is actually doing now. You have to look at that reader, the average reader who spends 34 minutes a month with the online New York Times, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You have to disaggregate those numbers and look closely, because you're going to find a percentage of those people, small percentage, but nevertheless a significant number, who actually are spending many more minutes than 34 minutes a month. Those are the frequent users of the New York Times, and the advertiser wants to reach those people because they're high income, and they probably are younger. And what you have to do is break those numbers out, the more frequent readers, and sell ads to the advertiser. Say, you want to reach these people? This is what you got to do, and the advertiser will pay more for that. And so that's part of the creative thing that they have to do. On the other hand, will that be enough? Jury's out.
So you're advocating, or at least you're pointing out that the Columbia paper is advocating the freemium model, where your incremental cost of serving one more customer is so low that you can afford to have 5 to 15% of your most avid customers support the other 85% of the operation.
That's right.
It's funny that Mel Karmazin, said that Google was fucking with the magic. What he calls magic, I might call deceptive practices.
I thought we had some good quotes from him in there that probably made that point.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, I'm wondering if, you know, well, two things. One, I'll ask the first one first. Isn't one of the, you know, you talk about people spending 34 minutes with the newspaper, nevertheless, isn't one of the dirty little secrets of print that, you know, you place an ad, but only a fraction of the people who look at the print edition are going to see that ad anyway?
Right.
And that now in digital, we actually know that. It's more provable.
Yeah, and that's something that scares some people, you know, for obvious reasons, because you want to... The digital fingerprint that is left is so compelling in terms of the data it produces that there will be people who won't want you to know what that data says.
Well, I mean, it's natural, right? If I'm General Motors or I'm the
right.
PepsiCo Corporation, isn't it normal that I want, you know, if I'm spending $10 million, I want to know who's actually seeing my ads?
Yeah, but the person who you're spending that $10 million with may not want you to know.
Right, but it's sort of...
Because it may be less efficient than they're selling you.
Well, caveat emptor, I guess, right?
Right.
A couple of students asked about China. Do you have anything to say about how Google's behaving in China? And
well,
you know,
I mean, there's a classic example of what might be called naivete. I mean, they went in thinking that, you know, everyone, the world's information should be free. That's their very noble belief system. That's fundamental to Google. All information should be free. And abstractly, we all agree with it. Except if you're not a democratic government, as China's not, you don't agree with it. So suddenly they start saying, well, you have to compromise, and we want to control these searches we don't want people to have. So Google says, well, we have to be in the largest consumer market in the world, so they compromise. And then a year later or 2 years later, they realize, my God, this is an onerous compromise. It's too onerous. And on top of that, they find out that their Gmail system is being hacked into, and they suspect by Chinese authorities. So they say, this is too big a price to pay. And I think Google made what is a very virtuous decision to say, screw it, we're not going to compromise with the Chinese government because it's a compromise of our fundamental values. That's a position that most companies dare not take, and Google had the balls to do that. And I think that's courageous on their part. It's going to be interesting to watch Facebook, because I think they're going to make an opposite decision. They're going to say, we want to be in the world's largest market, and that ultimately information and openness and the sense of community and transparency we can create through Facebook will slowly change the Chinese way of doing business. But what that means is that there will be dissidents who will be on Facebook that will be arrested, just as there were dissidents who were arrested because they used Yahoo some years ago. So this is a, you know, this is all going to play out in the next year with Facebook. But my sense is that's exactly where it's going.
Well, I mean, you said, you know, what Google did is virtuous, but maybe if you're an investor, which, you know, doesn't necessarily mean you're a big investor. You might be somebody who's part of your retirement fund is in Google. Maybe that's not a virtuous move.
That is correct, but then Google can come back, and I think fairly, and say, look at our IPO statement in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
When we went public, Larry Page and Sergey Brin wrote a letter to shareholders in which they said, we're going to have two classes of stock, and we're going to control the voting shares of those stocks because we want to be able to make decisions in the long-term interest of Google. Some investors on Wall Street won't think this is their interest. But we're going to operate and follow our own drum. And I think, you know, they were very transparent and open about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just doing what they said they might do in situations like this. And so I think, you know, they basically started off with a certain contempt for the short-term thinking of Wall Street and Wall Street investors. But on the other hand, if I'm a retiree and I've invested a lot of money in Google and I've enjoyed tremendous growth and profitability, on the other hand, I'm sitting there saying, oh my God, what are they doing? They're harming my investment. And so you have the option then to get
right.
another investment.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Another one of my students asked a question, said, it seems Google's power is not due to its innovations, talented staff, or sound business logic, but rather stems from the fact that customers, so far, trust Google to do the right thing. However, as Google continues to absorb knowledge and data, I assume there will be a point when customers may start to feel the same fear, mistrust, and cynicism Google's rivals fear toward them. although Google did plan ways to mitigate the trust issue, do you believe Google realizes that one day consumers may start to question Google's intentions and actively campaign against it, regardless of its public relations effort? Can obtaining too much data and knowledge slow down innovation or destroy a business model?
Yes, it can, and I think that's a good question. I think one that Google, for reasons we discussed earlier, is slow to recognize. This is a company with a very high IQ, but a relatively low EQ or emotional intelligence, instinct, things they can't measure, they're not so good at. And this is a basic issue. I mean, I think Google has a slogan, which a lot of people buy into, and Google believes, you know, don't do evil. But you know what does that mean? I mean, it's just a slogan. I mean, if I'm that shareholder you discussed, and my retirement funds are invested in Google, and suddenly they're jettisoning the China business, I think that's good? No. Is it evil? I wouldn't say it's evil, but it's not good. So therefore, it violates the sense I've had about Google. Or if Google becomes so large that they're beginning to favor, or they're charged with favoring their own content and search results, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that evil?
Well,
it is certainly in terms of what Google has promised. So, you know, that's why the brand, which has a very high recognition and very high support worldwide, is in danger. Just as the Microsoft brand was in danger. Just as a lot of companies, but just as Johnson & Johnson, when the Tylenol scandal broke, their brand was in danger. So this is all, you know, the world keeps moving. It doesn't stop. This is not a snapshot of Google at any point. It's a moving picture.
Well, another student asks, have Brin and Page thought about what happens when they're gone? In 100 years, will the inheritors of Google's business maintain the same ethical standard? Everything I've read so far in the book indicates they have a somewhat short-sighted view. Google is all about them, their vision today, their own lifetime. There's little serious thought about how to ensure the good intentions will continue beyond the tenure of the current management team. Did you ever discuss with them or with any of your interview subjects, do you have any insights regarding Brin and Page's thought about the long-term legacy of Google? What happens to all that valuable data after they're gone?
I don't think that two young men who are in their mid-30s think very much about succession and what's, you know, who's going to replace them. I mean, they see themselves having a very long life at Google. So the question is just, it would be alien to them. Hello?
Ken? Hi.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Ignore that beeping. That's my building trying to get me, and I just ignore it.
Okay. So do you think it's possible that a superior search can arise and oust all the great minds of Google? If so, wouldn't Google use its enormous connections and capital to simply acquire any threats? And that's the way student asked. I would ask it slightly differently.
I think you know, the threat to Google is a more efficient search. If you think about Google search, it's very inefficient. To get back tens of thousands of answers to a simple question is inefficient. You don't have time to go through those answers. So the danger is, for efficiency, is what's called a vertical search. And a vertical search means you get back few answers, it may be from experts, or think about it. I want to go buy a camera, right? And what is more efficient for me to put in Sony camera and get a search and get tens of thousands of results, or to put in Sony versus Samsung camera to my friends on Facebook and get 10 answers from friends of mine who've actually used one or the other of those cameras? That's a much more efficient search, and that terrifies Google, because in fact, look at Facebook, they have a like button. What is that like button? It's basically a search button, and it's aimed at the heart of Google search. And so this is really an issue that a company like Google worries about. One of the reasons they're trying to constantly tamper with their algorithms to improve it is to get more efficiency, because they know Google search is not efficient. But you know, think about it. Why didn't the New York Times 20 years ago or 15 years ago create their own search engine? Think of all the experts they have. Theater, movies, food, music. Times has all that. Travel. They have a file. Why didn't they, out of their archives, create New York Times search? Could have. And a much more efficient search.
And certainly the newspaper industry could have, even if the other times, you know, the collusion issues notwithstanding, the industry could have gotten together.
Right.
Do you... We were talking about, you know, legal issues. There's been a lot of attorneys general, the FTC launching an investigation, the EU. It seems Google's being hit on a lot of fronts. What do you think is going on there? You know, is it just that Google is it as they seem to be implying in their comments that just once you're big, people start launching attacks at you, or is it really this tenure for privacy, privacy and you know, other concerns that we were
Both. It's both. It's people fear bigness and size and dominance. That's why you have the Clayton Act and all the anti-monopoly. That's why Microsoft was forced to trial and lost, by the way. Why IBM was forced and AT&T was forced to break up, and IBM was brought before trial as well. So there's a long history of that in the United States, but in addition to that, the private issues like privacy, the European Union feels much more strongly about those issues than even we do in the United States. So privacy is aroused by the data that companies like Google or Facebook are collecting. But then copyright, you know, obviously there are a lot of companies that have a real argument that you know, we want to be compensated for our content. And they have the ear of a lot of people in places like Washington. And at the same time, they're endangered. But then if you look at who's bringing the suit against Google's size, it's people like companies like Microsoft that are basically saying Google is disadvantaging us in search, in our search engine, because they are favoring their own content, and that's unfair. So companies like Microsoft, which were charged with antitrust violations a decade ago, are bringing those same charges and keeping them, pushing them forward against Google. Interesting.
Yeah, it is. Here's another good versus evil question. Since child pornography is illegal and Google can help authorities track down, since child pornography is illegal and Google can help authorities crack down on those who consume it, don't they have a right or even an obligation to do so? They use harvested information to gain a buck. Why not use it to help prevent crimes?
Well, it's, you know, the problem you've got there is you get trade-off of values. I mean, you know, on the one hand, the people who want to prosecute and get that data from Google. On the other hand, there are people who say they don't want Google to have certain data because it violates privacy. And in order for Google to share that information with governments, they have to risk violating someone's privacy and have to be able to turn over. Now, what happens when and you do that because the government says you want it. Okay, make that argument. The government, you're going to obey the law of the U.S. government, which likes this information about child pornography. Are you then going to obey the Chinese government when they demand you release the names of dissidents?
Well, there are two things I observe about this. One is that in the Google's terms of service, there actually is a clause which basically says, if a law enforcement authority asks us for information, we have the right to turn it over, and by using Google services, you allow us to do so. On the other hand, there is at least one case I know of where Google has said no, and successfully fought a legal authority and said, no, we're not going to turn that information over to you, and the courts ruled in Google's favor. So, you know, on the one hand, Google is, in their terms of service, reserving their right to do so. On the other, they stood up to government and said, no, we're not going to. So I'm, you know, it's interesting. I see both sides of it, and I'm not sure what to believe.
What you believe is that it's really complicated, and it's very hard to lay out to draw a straight line, and it's a wiggly line, and sometimes, I mean, listen, what we don't hear about is the number of times that digital companies like Google basically turn over information, email information, and others under the Patriot Act to the government in order to track down terrorists or potential terrorists. And they're doing that under subpoena, and they're compelled to do it. On the other hand, there have been examples where Google has been subpoenaed and rejected it and fought it and won. So it's really, it's almost a thing where you have to make ad hoc decisions on a case-by-case basis. And it's very hard to enunciate a single principle that will cover all circumstances.
Well, that's very unengineering-like, right?
Very. But you know, one of the things we're witnessing is the education of Larry Page and Sergey Brin. I mean, they are compelled through what they're dealing with in daily life, imposed upon them by forces they don't control, like governments, right? To say, oh my God, this is complicated, and we can't just blissfully ignore it. And you know,
well, it's
delicious to watch. It's much more fun for journalists than it is for them, I'm sure.
Well, they have to, you know, make the best of imperfect choices.
As we all do.
Another question. One big rumor going around this week is that based on a recent job posting, Google is preparing to build a social gaming division. If this is true, how do you think this fits into the company's overall strategy? And given their spotty track record with other social initiatives like Buzz, how do you think they'll fare in this particular niche?
I don't know how they'll fare, but I know that Google is worried that social networking is a paradigm shift that could affect their business. We've already talked about one way, which is a like button and becoming a, you know, replacing,
well, and that's also
substituting to search.
And that's a threat to their revenue stream. We're already seeing ad dollars move into Facebook and potentially out of Google search.
Yes, and I mean today, according to ComScore, Facebook has more rich media ads or display advertising, generates more dollars than either Google or Yahoo, the two previous market leaders did. That's a huge shift and a big one. And so one of the things that Larry Page has said as the new CEO when he came back as CEO of Google is, I'm going to start judging people on their bonuses on how well we do in social networking. Because they know that Facebook is a real threat to their business model as well as a competitor to them. And therefore, they being Google, which has not been very successful in social networking over the years, he's going to try and jack up that part of their business. Will he succeed? They have not so far. So, that you know, and there's a fair argument that's being made that Google may lack the social networking gene that a company like Facebook has. But they're going to try. And, you know, history tells you don't easily bet against Google. On the other hand, based on experience, you would bet against them.
Well, you know, they basically got right now one very dominant revenue stream, which is clickable search ads. They've been trying to develop another important revenue stream. Do you see them being able to do so?
I do. I think Google has... Steve Ballmer made a very famous statement once that Google is a one-trick pony. But think about that. And what he meant was that search is their, you know, provides 97-98% of their income, which was true. But it's no longer true. And slowly you see it shifting. First of all, search, which has slowed down in terms of desktop search, right, and laptop search, look at how search is growing because of mobile. And if you understand one of the reasons why Google started Android is they understand there are 5 billion mobile phones in the world today. And those mobile phones are increasing, particularly with Android, featuring Google Search, right, which it does. And Android has 1/3 market share of the whole world right now. Google Search is growing much faster than it had been growing, A. But B, they have 3 other potential engines for growth. Android is one, and Android is a growth engine. And, you know, we talked about 1/3 market share in the world. But, you know, they're getting ads out of Android. And at some point, they could start charging telephone companies for the use of Android. So Android is a home run for them right now, and will continue to grow. And no one questions that. So that's a second pony. A third pony is YouTube. YouTube, which was scheduled to lose at the beginning of 2009 $1 billion that year, is now making money. And one of the reasons they're making money is because they're attracting advertising. And one of the reasons they're attracting the main reason they're attracting advertising is that there's more professional content on YouTube. So if you look at YouTube, you can see that in a couple of years, YouTube is actually aiming to go right after Netflix. They're going to charge pay-per-view. And for movies, for TV, and And that's, so YouTube is already a profit maker. That's a third pony. Their fourth pony, which is more problematic, is cloud computing. They're betting that instead of people paying money to, you know, a lot of money for packaged software from companies like Oracle or Microsoft, they'll store everything in the cloud, and much more cheaply they can access it through the Google Cloud. Will that work? That's a real question. They got a lot of competition in that area, and there's a real question whether people feel that cloud is secure. But Google is no longer a one-trick pony today.
Well, you touched on another question a student asked, which is, you know, you've got everybody moving into everybody else's turf. Apple, Google, Netflix, as you just said, Facebook. You know, are we moving into an era where just every company competes with every other company on every initiative?
What was that famous statement that in foreign policy there are no permanent alliances or permanent friends? There isn't. I mean, what you have is a world where you partner with people on some things and you compete with them on others. And that's long been true, and that's true in business history. And it's just, you know, and it would have appeared several years ago that Google was an adversary for media industries. And now you see in some cases that they're an ally. Certainly in the book industry, they're perceived as an ally. In the telephone industry, they're perceived as an ally. At the same time, you know, if you own a bookstore, you don't think of Google as an ally necessarily, because, you know, are they and all the digital companies ruining your business? You wonder, right? And if you're a telephone company, you say, well, I love the Android being free, and it's a good operating system for me. On the other hand, at what point is Google going to start squeezing me?
But even there, it's a double-edged sword, because I know that Powell's, I believe I read that somebody from Powell's books in California, or is it Oregon?
Yep.
They said, you know, because we were able to advertise on the web, and I believe on Google, we were able to sell that many more used books.
A. B. The other thing that Google is doing that Apple doesn't do, Google is saying that we will allow bookstores to set up a website and buy books off of Google and keep the lion's share of the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so Google is trying to work as a partner with bookstores, as they are with publishers. So, you know, again, you get back to the love-hate thing, where you'll love them and hate them.
Well, what can you say what most surprised...
But you need them.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
You
well,
can't forget.
It's what, the 800-pound gorilla, right?
That's right.
What most surprised you in your visits to and research of Google?
I guess the thing that I found a surprise is to understand what an engineer does, and I found that revelatory. To sit in those engineering meetings at Google and maybe understand half the words that were spoken, but having the luxury of time to have them translated for me. What I came to realize that the engineer, like Larry Page and Sergey Brin and Eric Schmidt, start with an attitude, which is the old ways of doing things are inefficient. And second, they begin with a question, which is why not? You know, why not offer free ads that the advertiser pays for only if someone clicks on them? Why not offer free Android operating systems, cell phones? You know, why not have YouTube and offer everything online? Why not digitize all the books? I mean, all those. Why not have Google News and digitize all the newspapers in the world and magazines? All those were why not questions, and that's the approach that an engineer takes. But I then learned from that, which was a second, for me, surprising and interesting thing, the limitations of an engineer. The engineer is really good at coming up with algorithms and answering those and coming up with devising why not answers. But they're not so good at understanding the consequences of that and how it might disrupt other people's business and therefore create pressure on you and government regulation of you. And that's what's playing out now.
Are there anything that Google's done since you did the book that stands out as a really new development or surprising or groundbreaking?
No, I was surprised by Larry Page coming back when he did. I knew he would at some point, but it was sooner than I thought he would. That was a surprise. But essentially, they're on track to do what they've...
How did you know he would come back?
Well, he had once been CEO, and you know, in the early days, an investment bank, the venture capitalist wanted him. I'm talking about in 98, 99, until they hired Eric Schmidt in August of 2001. Larry Page was the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
But the feeling was he wasn't experienced enough. He ultimately stepped down for Eric Schmidt, and Eric Schmidt had a 10-year run as CEO. But Eric Schmidt always knew, and Eric Schmidt is, what, 56 or so, that at some point Larry Page would run it. And in many ways, important, nothing was done without Larry's concurrence. Nothing big was done without his concurrence at Google. Everyone knew that, including, and Eric Schmidt was the first to say that.
Well, this has been really wonderful. Was there anything else you wanted to add just before we
break? I think we covered a lot, Doran.
We have. This is, yeah, it's been so wonderful. Would, you know, I this is for my class. Would you object to me writing about it or
whatever you like?
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Ken.
My pleasure, Doran. I enjoyed it.
Me too. Take
Thank
care.
You.
Bye-bye.